Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! A minute past the hour. It's Friday on the front porch on the horn. And what a Friday for sitting on the front porch it is. Absolutely beautiful outside in what's left of almost level West Virginia. Clouds that look to be 10 miles high piling up. Probably bringing a little bit of rain for this, the summer solstice. I think this is my favorite day of the year. I love the summer solstice. I can understand how being able to tell when it would fall and the equinoxes and everything would be very important to early human beings because they remain important to us allegedly modern ones. Granted, I probably would not have been prone, that's a joke. Go and do yoga in Times Square to mark the summer solstice. It's just enough to be out in the warm sunshine. The longest day of the year. I hope your summer solstice is going well or went well for you if you're on that part of the globe. Many thanks to all of you who joined in last night to meet Robert's Australian challenge for the 20th of the month and have continued to do so. I have happy news. We're done fundraising for the evening before the show even started. Thank you, Marty. Thank you, Janie. Thank you, Linda. Thank you all very kindly. It's taken care of, so there need be no further mention. Isn't that nice? So we had our West Virginia birthday party. Possum cakes fried in gopher gravy. Nah, I kid. But I really did enjoy the little bit of a diversion last night. I hope you did as well. It was, as Kate noted, nice to get out of the swamp for a little bit. And now I have a better understanding for why I use that analogy. Turns out, multi-great-grandfather sent multi-great-grandmother and his kids into the swamp during the heat of the day when they were busy stealing the land from the natives here. How about that? Fascinating, huh? This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where the Listen Live button is. And also, of course, you can listen in a wide variety of other streaming options, places like TuneIn Radio, places like the Stitcher Internet Radio app, the Tuner app, or TuneIn app. Yeah, podcast address for both this program and Dr. Bill O'Brien's Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution is available at whiterosesociety.org under the respective subdomains for the two programs. Help yourself. A program note, as a matter of fact, tomorrow, 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, which would make it noon Pacific Daylight Time, we will have a PRISM West Virginia chat session. PRISMWV.org, PRISMWV.org, is the home site for, or as we like to say here in the hills, the home place for the PRISM program. We've got a glitch in the embedded Ustream player over there, so If you want to watch the video, you'll have to go to ustream.tv and then simply look for Prism American History Chat. It'll pop right up when you go search. So, by all means, pop in. This is a leadership class, and there will be a chat this week and then next week, and then that's it for the present incarnation of the PRISM program. But the conceptual underpinnings will continue here in the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution. Okay? And by the way, of course, the audio of the PRISM chat will be available on the regular Horn stream. So any number of ways to listen in, and I hope you will. You've heard other people speak and write very eloquently about the rather profound nature of what Dr. Bill and Professor Keith do. Dr. Bill, you know from his own show and program, and of course you got a little immersive history lesson in West Virginia history just last evening on this program from Professor Keith. Note coming in from Kate. Bob, under the subject line, Happy Solstice. Bob, more signs of the end of the world as we know it. 300 miles north of me, Calgary has evacuated 75,000 folks. The downtown infrastructure has been demolished. The downstream towns haven't even been hit by the surge yet. Since I don't have TV, I don't know if this is news or not. I have no way of knowing what others know about world news, but this doesn't feel like world news because it's only 300 miles north of me. My valley here isn't in any danger, unless the Missouri River starts rising with the local rains and upcoming storm fronts. Makes you want to go, Signed, Kate, still high and dry. Might ought to have a look. And let's do. Wowzer. As of an hour ago, MSN reporting, good God, look at that. About 75,000 people in Calgary neighborhoods have already been evacuated due to floodwaters, and officials say as many as four may have died. Flooding forced the western Canadian city of Calgary, which, of course, is in the province of Alberta. Isn't there something else going on in Alberta that I should... It's kind of like one of those itches you can't scratch. They're doing something up in Alberta. Damn it. Now what? Oh, the tar sands. Flooding forced the western Canadian city of Calgary to order the evacuation of the entire downtown area on Friday as the waters reached the 10th row of the city's hockey arena. Communities throughout southern Alberta were inundated by overflowing rivers that washed out roads and bridges, soaked homes, and turned streets into dirt brown waterways. Police say as many as four people may have died. About 350,000 people work downtown on a typical day. However, officials said very few people need to be moved out since many heeded warnings and did not go to work on Friday. 25 neighborhoods in the city with an estimated population of 75,000 have already been evacuated due to floodwaters. Calgary has a population of more than 1 million people. The place is a wreck. And it's not just Calgary. Goodness me. Helicopters have had to be utilized to pick people off of rooftops in the area. People have been rescued by boat. People have been rescued in the buckets of heavy machinery. Further west, in the mountain town of Canmore, the river is ripping at house foundations. Is this, and I confess a certain degree of ignorance of that the geography of that area. Is this just one of those things? I mean, the people who founded Calgary just happened to cite it right on top of a river that flooded all the time? Or might this be a bit of an anomaly? Might this be unusual? I was looking at... I noticed something kind of interesting last night as the program was ending, and of course we didn't really do a lot of other news, as it were. But in the course... Oh, Lordy, here we go with another one. We'll get to it. But in the course of my reading on any given day, I ran across a story that I thought fascinating. We know, of course, that there's an immigration bill being debated in the Senate. And I thought it interesting that one of the senators from Hawaii, the junior senator from Hawaii, Democrat Brian Schatz, filed an amendment to the immigration bill. He did this on Wednesday. That would allow people who have come to the U.S. as stateless persons, which is what you kind of claim when you're... when life has been rendered entirely too dangerous for you to live in your home country. When war, famine, things like that happen. But Brian Schatz's amendment adds something new to the list of causes for stateless refugee status. Climate change. It recognizes that people can be rendered stateless by the destruction wreaked by the natural forces that we have unleashed unnaturally, that we generally recognize under the rubric of climate change. Brian Schatz said, "The amendment I am proposing is quite simple. If enacted, the Secretary of Homeland Security, in consultation with the Secretary of State, may designate individuals or a group of individuals displaced permanently by climate change as stateless persons." Again, let me be clear about what this amendment does. It simply recognizes that climate change, like war, is one of the most significant contributors to homelessness in the world. And like with states torn apart and made uninhabitable by war, we have an obligation not to deport people back to a country made uninhabitable by sea level rise and other extreme environmental changes that render these states desolate. It does not grant any individual or group of individuals outside the United States with any new status or avenue for seeking asylum in the United States. I think this is an incredibly, very, terribly, tremendously rational thing. And it does not surprise me that a senator from the state of Hawaii would be the one to propose it. Because sea level rises occasion horrible flooding and, in some cases, the actual disappearance of entire islands from the category of dry ground. Climate-related disasters forced more than 32 million human beings out of their homes just last year alone. In particular, the problems are most notable in the continent of Africa and the continent of Asia. We are accustomed, I suppose, to think about climate-related disasters and so-called natural disasters as happening in places like Asia and Africa. The flooding in New Delhi, the monsoon season has come much earlier than usual, and the flooding in the Indian subcontinent is pestilential. But now, I mean, doesn't, as Kate notes, doesn't that strike you as a little bit, isn't that unusual to find an entire so-called first world city evacuated because of flooding? But of course, we must understand that Brian, for instance, Brian Schatz's amendment will probably die a miserable death in the Senate, because the minority of climate change deniers that run the Senate won't let it through because, well, they don't believe it in it. They don't believe in it in the first place, because they think science is just like religion. You can believe in it or not believe in it, and if you don't, but unlike religion, not believing in it won't get you tormented for all eternity by the loving God who created you so that he could throw you in a lake of fire and barbecue your ass. Have I got that right? Yeah. So that's, you know, that's a start. A starting place. Apparently President Obama is going to try to use executive orders and things that he can do solely through the executive branch to try to start to move the United States toward some semblance of responsibility or responsible conduct where the climate disaster unfolding as it is concerned. This, of course, will occasion howling, screeching, poo-flinging by the majority over in the House of Representatives, and an absolute heels-dug-in stance, line in the sand, and all of that stuff. By the Republican minority that runs the Senate of the United States. Okay. I said last night that I had a story that I wanted to share with you. Texas Betsy alerted me to it. But I didn't get to it last night. And it's kind of a good thing I didn't, because lo and behold, we've got an addendum to it that arrived in the mail today. We are the sort of weirdos who actually participate in the political process. And as a consequence, Agnes periodically sends emails to her senators and member of the House of Representatives. She got a letter back today from Joe Manchin. It's a real Lulu, too. But a reminder, this being Friday on the front porch, it is entirely appropriate for you to bring to the fore stories that you think are important, and we'll call them as we see them. But this one really got me going. It's a story from over at Chicken Noodle News, CNN. And it has to do with the fact that the National Republican Rifle Association has been running ads against Joe Manchin here in West Virginia Stan. And Joe don't much care for it. Ashley Kalou Jones, K-I-L-L-O-U-G-H, Ashley, writes over at CNN, and this is an interesting, it's not a byline, it says posted by CNN's Ashley Killow. Is that, I don't know. Anyway, Ashley writes, Senator Joe Manchin is firing back. It's a National Rifle Association story, so naturally we're going to use some gun and eliminationist imagery. Thanks, Ashley. Senator Joe Manchin is firing back after the National Rifle Association targeted, well, this is getting creepy early, the conservative Democrat in a television commercial last week. The senator from West Virginia said Thursday morning that the NRA is using paranoia to keep lawmakers from making big moves on gun control, none of which Joe Manchin has ever supported. Those big moves, you know, things like criminalizing the possession of semi-automatic military style, you know, AR-15 type, right, criminalizing that or the possession of them. Those are big moves. Right. Following the Newtown, yada, yada, yada. Quote, so Senator Joe went and appeared on Morning Joe. Ick. And said, why do we ask to be policymakers and be involved in the public process when we're afraid basically to engage? I'm not afraid to engage. The worst they can do is defeat me and send me home to my family in the state I love, West Virginia. That's a pretty good consolation. What are we afraid of? Come on home, Joe. Not that I want a weirder person up there or a more Republican person than you. Remember, it's a truism in the state of West Virginia that no person named Manchin ever voted for a Democrat whose name wasn't Manchin. The Manchin gang has a Republican streak that's about 50 miles wide. But notice something in that quote. It's one of those moments where maybe Dr. Freud comes over and but no, we'll leave him be. Speaking of the NRA, he says, the worst they can do is defeat me. Isn't that in its own right a sort of sad acknowledgement of the power of the NRA? The worst they can do is defeat me and send me home to my family. The NRA, he admits, has the power to defeat him, despite the will of the people of the state of West Virginia. Now, Joe ran away with his election last time. He was up against a real Lulu from the Republican Party, a guy who was convinced that a county health department passing an ordinance that says there will be no smoking in his buildings is exactly the same thing as being put aboard cattle cars and shipped off to a Nazi death camp. The same thing. That is why Joe won, you know, going away. Right? But Joe admits that the NRA could defeat him and send him home to West Virginia, a state he loves. Joe countered with his own TV ad pushing back against the National Republican Rifle Association. Now, Joe says that when he says big moves on gun control, what Joe means is having background checks at gun shows and for internet firearm and ammunition sales, maybe. That ain't a big move. That's something that's simple enough that, well, anybody but a Republican could understand it. He says he is still, Joe is, still a strident defender of the Second Amendment. But it's the following quote Oh, and remember when I was talking about all that nasty talk that we typically engage in about Washington, D.C.? About how it's the problem is Washington. I'm a Washington outsider, and that's why you should send me to Washington. I'll take a message to Washington. I'll send a message to Washington. Right? And various similar palaver. Well, Joe wants to bring common sense to Washington. There's no small amount of hubris involved in a statement like that, because it presumes that Joe is the only one who possesses any of said common sense, and that he is some sort of angel of mercy delivering it to the non-commonsensical in our nation's capital. Really, Joe? Common sense? But we'll just blow past that one for the moment. In his ad released yesterday, Joe says, I'm a lifetime NRA member, but I don't walk in lockstep with the NRA's Washington leadership, this administration, or any special interest group. Now, he does this all the time with a gun in his hand. Jeebus. Joe spent $100,000 on this ad. And part of that money went to place it on TV on TV stations all around this now 150-year-old state. It's going to run for a week. In the ad, he says, West Virginia, you know me. I haven't changed. I'm not a witch. I'm you. Oh, no, wait, that was Christine O'Donnell. West Virginia, you know me. I haven't changed. You know I've always fought for our gun rights. Joe Manchin has never fought. Football me, right? Joe's never fought for diddly. It's a complicated hillbilly term, diddly. Fought for gun rights, mine. Our gun rights don't need any fighting for. It would seem, because this country, as we are periodically reminded, would rather see 7-year-old girls not be able to become 8-year-old girls because some pusillanimous punk-ass in busted knuckle Alabama feels he's going to be ready and take on the government when it becomes tyrannical. Right? Idiots. I've always fought for our gun rights. I believe that we can protect the Second Amendment and make the community safer. I think most law-abiding gun owners agree. Yeah, those lawful gun owners. They're lawful gun owners until they're not. Didn't some lawful gun owner go ape shit in North Carolina today and kill 4 people? Well, that's just how it is when you're a lawful gun owner. Yeah, the line's so blurry. One minute you're a lawful gun owner, and the next minute you're gunning down 4 people, and then you're not anymore. How's a lawful gun owner to know where to draw the line? But I want to go back to that line, because this is the one that sent me running around the room. I'm a lifetime NRA member, but I don't walk in lockstep with the NRA's Washington leadership, this administration, or any special interest group. By this administration, he means that one in his White House. Joe couldn't run away from Barack Obama fast enough in 2012. But that line, I don't walk in lockstep with the NRA's Washington leadership, this administration, or any special interest group. Any special interest group, Joe? Any? ANY? Not even one special interest group that you walk in lockstep with? See, if there was really a great big vindictive juvenile delinquent with a big white fuzzy beard in the sky, even while you were filming that, Joe, and you uttered those words, he would have sent a lightning bolt down and turned you into a greasy spot. For lying. Because you're lying, Joe. You do march in lockstep with a special interest group. It's called the coal industry. And you don't just march in lockstep with it. You march in lockstep while you're beating the drum that people are lockstepping to. And that's why, Joe, you won't even acknowledge the existence of more than 20 peer-reviewed, scientific, published articles that point to the fact that you're lockstep marching with the coal industry is poisoning babies in the womb, is keeping fathers from becoming grandfathers, mothers from becoming grandmothers, four-year-olds from becoming five-year-olds, is imposing a toxic tax upon people who live near mountaintop removal and who have no choice but to pay it to satisfy the murderous, profiteering, avarice-driven urges of those people with whom you do, Joe, you really, really do march lockstep. $4,000 excess deaths annually in West Virginia mountaintop removal communities. Men, women, children, babies in the womb born with birth defects they wouldn't have if it weren't for the fact that they live in mountaintop removal communities. And each and every one of them, each and every one of those stories, each and every one of them a personal horror to those who have to live through it. Joe will not even acknowledge exist. See, Joe's busy being statesmanlike. Somewhere along the way, somebody has whispered in his ear that he has vice presidential timber. And he's thinking maybe he'd like to be, oh, I don't know, Hillary's running mate in 2016. Or maybe the vice presidential nominee of a sort of hybrid ticket, a third way ticket, where a reasonable Democrat and a reasonable Republican run together. Oh, all of these things are swirling, swirling, swirling through those spider-webby places that pass for Joe's monumental ego. Any special interest? What is the coal industry in this state if it's not a special interest group? Well, it's not a special interest group, Bob. It's the only interest group. You damn tree huggers are out there just trying to ruin the fun for the rest of us. God almighty. And then today, this. A letter from Joe to Agnes. Thank you for contacting me and sharing your thoughts about S-954, the Agriculture Reform, Food, and Jobs Act of 2013, paren, quote, farm bill, close quote, close paren, and your support for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP. I appreciate the time you took to share your perspective with me, and I value the opportunity to hear your thoughts. Bullshit. The 2013, and I love congressional letters like this, where they basically regurgitate back at you something that a bill does that you already knew in the first damn place or you wouldn't have written. The 2013 Farm Bill makes responsible changes to our existing agricultural programs while still giving American farmers a safety net that allows them to continue to provide the food we need. By American farmers, of course, we mean Cargill and ConAgra and Monsanto and that bunch. Or maybe a certain right-wing, pig-licking member of the House from Tennessee who gets a $70,000 check just for getting up in the morning. Because he's a farmer, even if he isn't. Safety net. Remember, it's a safety. Wait a minute. Ordinary folks need something, there's a Republican out there to worry about a safety net becoming a hammock. But when it's a giveaway to big agriculture, well, that's not a hammock. That's a safety net. Poor little things might fall down. These changes support 16 million jobs while reducing spending by $17.9 billion. The Farm Bill also protects The Farm Bill also protects the integrity of SNAP by reducing waste, fraud, and abuse and making sure that children and families get the nutrition they need, only not nearly as much of it as before, having cut some $4 billion from the SNAP program. You will be happy to learn that on May 3rd, 2013, I signed a letter asking Chairwoman Debbie Stabenow to fully fund SNAP in the Farm Bill, which they then cut by, again, $4 billion. But it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough. Once again, I am very proud that the amendment I sponsored along with Senator Kelly Ayotte, R. New Hampshire, last year was included in S-954. He's pals with Kelly, except for the fact that, well, she and the NRA don't see quite eye to eye with Joe, because Joe hasn't apparently succeeded in bringing Kelly his common sense yet. But anyway, let's see. This amendment would require the Department of Health and Human Resources and the Department of Agriculture to develop, implement, and promote national dietary guidelines for pregnant women and children between the ages 0 and 2 years of age. Really? Pregnant women between the ages of 0 and 2 years of age? Oh, we got somebody in the Joe Manchin office needs to work a little harder on his art of word knowing. So Joe wants to have us some dietary guidelines for pregnant women between 0 and 2 years of age. There's some of that common sense he's bringing to Washington. But once again, I find it interesting that Joe's out there worrying about what pregnant women eat, but when the pregnant women are in a mountaintop removal community, he doesn't give a good goddamn about what they're breathing. I supported the farm bill and was pleased that we could come together as Democrats and Republicans to pass this significant piece of legislation that screws poor people to the wall. Oh, wait, no, no, no. That supports local economies, jobs, promotes good health, and responsibly reduces our national debt. Yeah. Because that's what we need to do, right? We need to reduce the national debt on the backs of people who are just trying to eat $3 worth of food a damn day. What a load of crap. But as I noted, nothing to fear, because among other things, well, the House of Representatives considered the farm bill and they turned it down. It was their own version of the farm bill. They being the poo-flinging sociopaths and psychopaths of the Republican Party, turned down the farm bill because it cut a hell of a lot more money out of the food stamp program than that pissant $4 billion from over at the Senate. But it failed because it didn't cut enough out of the food stamp program. Snap. Even with, like, $12 billion in cuts, the Republican Party felt like there would still be too many Americans eating too much free food. Really? Which brings me to something that our Cassie wrote yesterday. Cassie is on her way to finishing up at Princeton, and she will do so in very good order. And we are all immensely proud of her. She doesn't have as much time to write as I wish she did, because when she gets at it, she's pretty good. She's darn good. In a post over at CassieAtCollege.com, just like it sounds, CassieAtCollege, snap Congress, and my career goals. Shame on Congress. Shame for even considering life-risking cuts to the SNAP program. Shame on them further for the proposal to deny SNAP benefits to convicted felons. How is it that the same people that would restrict birth control and abortion will also restrict assistance for prenatal care? Children, and the food for children. They're tough on crime while eliminating the transition programs that help convicts return to society and get jobs. Without jobs, how do they live an honest life? Without jobs or SNAP or WIC, how do they feed their families? The answer, Cassie writes, is that our elected leaders do not work for us. Convicted felons and poor children don't make campaign contributions or offer lucrative lobbying jobs to retiring elected officials, and so they don't count. Their hunger doesn't matter. Their futures don't matter. In the world of government, only the rich matter. Welcome to our, and thank God she put it in quotes, democracy, unquote. I write often about my struggles growing up, Cassie continues. I was hungry, but my brother made sure we applied for food stamps. At the time, my mother had already been convicted of drug crimes at least once. But we got SNAP. We got school breakfast and lunches. We ate, and because we ate, we could study and learn and affect our own futures. Because we ate at home and at school, we didn't steal. We didn't quit school. My brother went into the Army and became a mechanic, and I was sent to college, where I am now looking at law schools. Law? Yes, law. Not to defend the big banks against government regulators. Not to work in a district attorney's office. Law school, because it is the next and best step to prepare me to advocate for those whose voices are not heard in Washington or by state governments. I am going to law school in order to become an advocate for the poor, for poor children, for released convicts trying to live an honest life. I was extremely lucky to survive my childhood and thrive in my education. I had tremendous help and luck every step of the way, and continue to enjoy the good counsel, occasional financial assistance, and indescribable emotional support from adults who chose to be part of my life. But luck didn't feed me or educate me when my mother was unable to purchase food. The government did, through SNAP and school lunches. Someone needs to make sure they continue that for the next Cassie. And that someone is me. Go, Cassie. Go. Fly as if on wings. And protect that idealism that you have there for all you're worth. Michael writing in, bumper stickers from hell, Paul Manchin, 2016, America deserves a third way, or Paul Manchin, 2016, no one will miss a hill or two, or 500. Sheesh. But I'll take you a horrifying another step, Michael. Try Hillary Manchin 2016. How's that grab you? Because that's what the talk is. Someone is telling him that he has vice presidential timber and that, well, you know, he could help deliver places like Appalachia for Hillary. Okay, so goodbye, Joe. Yeah. Just clearing the stacks. It's about 11 minutes before the hour. Friday on the front porch here on the Horn. And, Lordy, no small amount of fun to be had in the evening. And some serious stuff, too. Having a quick swing over to the Supreme Court. Where a decision was handed down yesterday. Of course, we're still waiting for the biggies, the Voting Rights Act, things like that. They did get one case right last week, patenting human genes, and they all said, ick, ew, no. But no, This case in particular has to do, and it's an 8-1 decision, and it had to do with enhanced sentencing criteria. Sounds kind of arcane, but the fact of the matter is, the Congress, way back in the 80s, decided that they weren't so fond of Article III judges, federal judges who serve on good behavior. You have to impeach them out of office once they're in there, once they've gotten confirmed. And the Congress decided that they were going to impose rules on how judges went about sentencing people. And they haven't stopped since. Which brings us to a case called Descamps versus the United States, and a challenge to something called the Armed Career Criminal Act. Like I said, it was an 8-1 decision. With the majority deciding to strike it down. It's a matter of whether or not in this particular case, Matthew Descamps, who had pled guilty to burglary in California, and was subjected to this Armed Career Criminal Act. So, after his guilty plea, the trial court enhanced his sentence under the Armed Career Criminal Act, and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said, yep, sounds good to us. The Supreme Court, however, again, by an 8-1 margin, and when it's 8-1, you got to think, wow, how come that one guy couldn't come along, or woman? Wonder who that was. And then, oh look, it's Samuel Alito. The guy who, while an appeals court judge, once wrote that it was perfectly okay for police to shoot a fleeing black man in the back of the head, even if he was not armed and posed no threat whatsoever. They could just gun him down like a dog. Sam Alito said, fine by me! And apparently, Sammy didn't much care for being the lone wolf on this particular case, and he got kind of snarky because there was actually mention in the majority opinion, which you can go and look up if you want to, of something that I spent many happy hours doing as a child, playing the game Clue. And it's become kind of ubiquitous to reference, you know, Miss Plum in the billiard room with the rope. So forth. So there was a reference to the game, believe it or not, in a Supreme Court opinion of the United States, there was a reference to the game of Clue, which Samuel Alito, for some reason, felt like he had to pick up and run with. And he says, and really, if you're baffled by Clue, you're probably baffled by your shoelaces, but well, we're talking about Samuel Alito here. The board game Clue, to which the court refers, see ante at 18, does not provide sound legal guidance. Way to set up that straw man, Sam. Just knocking the stuffing out of it. Well, it's all stuffing. Just beating it to the... Yes, you are. Hit it again, Sam, and put a little stank on it. The board game Clue does not provide sound legal guidance. In that game, and see, this is one of those moments where you realize that there is a little bit of truth in that old adage. There's an old joke that lawyers tell each other, and it goes like this: What do you call a lawyer with an IQ of 12? And the answer is Your Honor, because quite frequently they're not very good lawyers. The board game Clue does not provide sound legal guidance. In that game, it matters whether Colonel Mustard bashed in the victim's head with a candlestick, wrench, or lead pipe. But in real life, the colonel would almost certainly not escape conviction simply because the jury was able to agree on the particular type of blunt instrument that he used to commit the murder. Maybe just how goddamn dumb Samuel Alito is will be clearer if I won't use the cute voice. In that game, it matters whether Colonel Mustard bashed in the victim's head with a candlestick, wrench, or lead pipe, but in real life, the colonel would almost certainly not escape conviction simply because the jury was unable to agree on the particular type of blunt instrument that he used to commit the murder. You ever worked in front of a jury, Sam? You ever gone through the painstaking business of preparing jury instructions for that to be read to that jury, Sam? If you have, it's been a long damn time, ain't it? We have real, live, honest-to-goodness, no-kidding lawyers in this audience who are probably tearing at their clothing and howling like jungle beasts right now. In a criminal case tried to a jury, and by the way, the case at bar in this particular piece of Supreme Court work, which 8 got the right answer to and Sam Alito necessarily got effing wrong, because that's what he's paid by you, me, we the people. He's paid to be wrong. Almost all the time. Oh, good morning, dear. I'm ready for some supper. I think I'll go out and get clean by rolling in the dirt. Dry off in a deep and steamy soaking tub. If you try, in almost every jurisdiction, if you try a criminal case to a jury, which this case did not involve, it involved a guilty plea. Rule one is that all the jurors, 4, 6, 12, whatever, have to agree. Now, we're not talking about grand juries here. The verdict has to be unanimous in a criminal case. That's a nicety to which I am fairly strongly attached. But what Sam Alito, well, he doesn't seem to grasp that one for starters. Because he said the colonel would almost certainly not escape conviction simply because the jury was unable to. Well, yes, he could. It is possible for juries to be able to come up with everything but a murder, how the murder was committed, and for the jury to then decide that they cannot reach a finding of fact to a degree of reasonable certainty beyond a reasonable doubt that the murder was committed by the defendant. Or, more to the point, if the jury determined, despite all the evidence, and juries do make rather howling blunders from time to time, let's say that the trial has gone on and it's been lead pipe, lead pipe, lead pipe, lead pipe, And for some reason, and nobody really, until you've been on a jury, you're never going to know how a jury reaches its decision. It is a mystery beyond even the mystery of the mass, how juries reach decisions. Because they're not supposed to bring biases or anything like that into the process, but they're human beings. And their decision process can be flawed, or it can be wrong. In this case, let's say the evidence has been all along through the lead pipe, lead pipe, lead pipe, lead pipe. But for some reason or another, the jury decides that the defendant did it with a gold-plated candelabra. Candlestick. Well, that's a mistake of fact. And a verdict rendered on a candlestick, when the evidence is clear that if it is to be a conviction, it is a conviction of murder by lead pipe, well, that'll yes, Sam Alito, that will invalidate the conviction. Now, we must remember that Sam does not write his own opinions. He's got some hotshot who just graduated first in his class at Harvard or Yale or Michigan or Stanford, who is very good at this kind of arcana because that's the kind of crap they teach in law school. Maybe it would be helpful if said clerk would take the time to, I don't know, get together with the other clerks and play a little Clue. Because it's pretty clear the clerk plus Samuel Alito ain't got one. So that's the first hour of this Friday on the Front Porch. Join in. This is not, it ain't no fun here on the Front Porch all by one's lonesome. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Yeah, the song's a little bit dated with the reference to the USSR will be open soon as vacation land for lawyers in love. But, yeah, what the heck? Yeah, it's Supreme Court. How many? Well, there's always lawyers, guns, and money, but. Bumper music. Whatever. Look, it's 7 minutes past the hour, and let's get the conversation started right away. Sandra's with us on the Skype line. Hey, Sandra.
Hey, Bob. Can you hear me?
Got you good.
Oh, good. Yeah, so that Joe Manchin stuff is interesting. What the hell?
Oh, we've gotten used to it, but it's still pretty infuriating. I think I've got an op-ed to write over the weekend.
Well, I mean, I can't, you know, it's just, I'm upset that it escaped my mind, but I saw his name recently voting against something that I was shocked. He was on the right side. I can't remember what bill it was. Anyway, maybe it'll come to me, but I was quite surprised. He was like one of four people who, oh, anyway, I don't know. I was just thinking about that Trans-Pacific Partnership business. I mean, did you realize that, okay, first of all, we don't have a free trade agreement with Japan. Now, I don't know, maybe people thought we did, but we don't. And the point I want to make is that they import 45% of their natural gas. And if we were to, you know, if we were to sign this agreement with them, the level of fracking would just explode. Hence, there's 25 liquid natural gas terminals, you know, in the works.
In Japan or here?
No, here.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing about
those giant explosive things.
Well, they're building. Exxon is building a huge one on the west coast somewhere in Canada. They just got permission from the government there. But what it would do to the fracking here, because you know, that's a huge amount of gas that market would open up. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely.
Right, and that's what one thing that the Trans-Pacific Partnership would do. And you have to remember that it takes a long time for these natural gas terminals to be sorted. But guess what? If you have a free trade agreement with a country, the Department of Energy has to expedite it.
Wait, so that means they just shove it through with a
right,
sort of...
Right, by law, if it's involving a country where we have a free trade agreement, then, you know, all kinds of things fall by the wayside. So anyway, to bring it back, what I'm saying is that this is just another aspect that I haven't really heard people talking about when we're talking about the horror show that is the TPP.
And I think you know, when you talk about the natural gas aspect of it, Sandra, I know I'm weird. The first thing I thought of was what I was saying about when we found out that Smithfield was being bought by the Chinese, Smithfield Meats.
Yeah.
And the question I asked was, these slaughter operations are already toxic, environmental, human rights, human health nightmares as it is. What happens when we have to ramp up production in the United States to meet the hunger of a couple of billion people?
Well, and also...
And the same thing applies to this natural gas thing. It's a reason to continue fracking and frack harder, faster, more, whatever. I mean, there are... The University of Tennessee, for God's sakes, is taking bids for fracking in land that it owns. Now there's a university in New York, maybe, that's doing the same thing. I mean, it's the whole country is gone wild over this, regardless of any health impacts to the human beings who have to live near it.
Right, and just think, if you add a country, which is Japan, which is the third largest economy in the world, and, you know, they're already, trying to get out from under the nuclear umbrella. So if that market is open to us and they import – nearly 45% of their natural gas. I mean, it boggles the mind because, you know, there's this whole term in international relations called resource curse.
Yes.
You know, and it plagues countries like Nigeria would be the poster child for that. And
or maybe West Virginia.
And Saudi Arabia is another example. I mean, I'm talking about countries. I mean, yeah. But, and, you know, what it entails is, I mean, it's cursed because intuitively you would think that having all those resources would bring in all this money, blah, blah, blah. But you know what it does. What it does, it brings all the money in and it's, you know, shuffled off to the elites. All the social needs are falling by the wayside. You know, no one cares about education, anything like that. So there's a set of standards that go with countries that are considered resource curse, and it's always horrible for the citizenry. So there's
right.
no
and the reason. Near and the nearer you are to the resource in question, the higher the rate of poverty becomes.
Right. Well, hence the struggle that's going on in Canada, because Canada is rapidly becoming, you know, is going to suffer from the resource curse, and it's antithetical to a safety net, social safety nets, you know, retirement benefits, health benefits. It doesn't work very well. So you can see how Canada is struggling along with this horrible conservative government pulling out of the what was it? Is it Kyoto? The global trade? The global warming?
Yeah, the Kyoto protocols.
Yeah. Right, they pulled out of that, you know, and it's all just a nightmare, and their nightmare is trying to become our nightmare because of this pipe that they want to send all the way down that serves no benefit to the citizens of the U.S. and Canada. The only people this pipeline serves is this ongoing global corporate regime that Obama is doing his damnedest to secure before he leaves the hell out of office.
And cashes the check.
Well, whatever. But, I mean, this is the thing about Obama that, you know, I think people need to understand. And I'm not, you know, I don't mean to come on hating on him. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying this is what he's working hard on is the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, you and I, and maybe people in the Horn family, and people who listen to Mike Malloy, and maybe people who are savvy on the computer may know about the TPP, but I'll guarantee you, the first time most people heard about it was when Obama talked about it at the State of the Union address.
And if they even paid any attention to that. You know, look, there's a reason the American people are worked as hard as they are. There's a reason, for instance, in Florida that Rick Scott vetoes a bill or signs that eliminates any possibility of paid sick days off. Americans are supposed to keep their noses down, their noses to the grindstone, their heads down, and not pay attention to this stuff. Walmart America doesn't know TPP from TP.
No, I mean, but it's just, you know.
TP stands for two-ply, because who likes that single-ply stuff anyway?
Right. I mean, no, and it's just stunning, and it's interesting that, I mean, I don't know if you heard about it, but the whole, what is that congressman from Florida, the one that's quite interesting?
Grayson?
Grayson. He came out recently talking about he actually had a look-see at this document and explained the whole protocol and how it's, he was only able to allow it because it's top secret. Now, first of all, why should a trade agreement like this be classified as top secret? Who's it being, you know what I mean? I mean, right there is a huge problem. When the only people who are able to see this agreement are the 600 giant multinationals at the table. They're the only people who are seeing this agreement. They're the only people who are benefiting from it. And we were told by Senator Warren that if the public saw this, they would not want it, which is why it needs to be kept secret. Do you understand how outrageous that is?
It is past outrageous.
I mean, I don't even know what to say. I feel the need to repeat it again. Senator Warren said that this agreement is not being made public because the public would hate it so much that it wouldn't pass. It sounds like Bush v. Gore again.
Yeah, where if only the American people were engaged, then a certain, right, yeah.
Well, no, remember that decision was, well, we have to give the presidency to Bush because he'll be hurt if we don't. Remember?
Right.
Right.
The pleading was that Bush would be irreparably harmed,
right,
you know, by losing the election because he lost the election if he wasn't given the presidency.
Right. It's the same kind of logic and bullshit. But, you know, we hear a congressman saying that, Grayson, and a senator saying that, Elizabeth Warren, who better watch out or they're going to Dennis Kucinich her ass. I'm telling you.
Well, I think you're probably right.
And, but no. I mean, all respect to her, but, you know, she's stepping, I mean, the banking is bad enough, and now she's stepping into this? Damn. I mean, I was glad to hear it, but I was taken aback. I'm like, wow, okay.
So yeah, she's not going to back down. She's going to go what
interesting.
She perceives that she was sent there to be and to do. Well, yeah. You know, there's an overarching principle at work here, though, Sandra, and I think it's worth at least focusing on for a moment or two. And that is, we are witnessing in the northern part of the Western Hemisphere, i.e. North America, we are witnessing a total paradigm-shifting transformation. It used to be that America, in particular, and Canada to a certain extent as well, externalized our environmental plundering onto other countries.
Right.
Well, that worm has turned.
Yeah.
And now the rest of the world is externalizing theirs onto us.
No, but it's not the rest of the world, though.
Well, no.
I disagree. It's a cabal of multinational corporations and the elite politicians who cater to them. And I don't care if that sounds, I don't mean for it to sound conspiratorial, but no, we're talking about a small percentage of a population doing this, because if they want to, the TPP is sort of a way for a corporate power to finally overtake sovereignties of all the countries involved in this agreement. So,
right,
you know,
because the secrecy stuff that Elizabeth Warren was talking about a couple of days ago was shocking. I mean,
well,
it made your head spin.
No, I mean,
what I mean when I say the rest of the world is externalizing onto us, you know, the excuses being put forward by these plutocrats and oligarchs is that the burgeoning middle class of China and India demand it, and therefore they've got to do it.
Now, no, but they're still lying though, because,
well, yeah, they absolutely are.
Well, no, because people here still seem to think that these energy policies are going to translate into lower fuel prices. But, of course, we're still sitting at $4 a gallon, and we've been there. So this all and above energy policy that Obama is running on people, it's not bringing the, gas prices down. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
And they just keep lying and saying somehow that, you know, having a pipe that may threaten and probably will threaten water for 30 million Americans is somehow going to benefit us. I mean, to me, the fact that he hasn't said no to this already, I'm not buying it. I just think that he's trying to worm his way into explaining somehow, maybe with this initiative next week to regulate emissions. He gonna do one of them combos where he thinks, you know, fossil fuel and renewables are somehow equal, and we can have both.
Or that one balances the other.
No, you can hear it. I can write the speech for what he's gonna be saying. It's gonna be vintage Obama, but it is a nightmare because we're not talking about deficits now. Okay.
Right.
We're talking about the planet. I don't care about his legacy. Fuck him. But these decisions that he's coming up with his bipartisan approach is just horrendous.
What did you think of this? See, I was taken aback by the irony of that speech in front of the Brandenburg Gate yesterday, in Berlin. Because, you know, there's the German Reichstag that was rebuilt and redesigned even, and it's a monument of sustainability. I mean, it's got geothermal, it's got solar, it's got wind, it's beautiful. I mean, it's breathtakingly beautiful. And you've got an entire nation that is absolutely busting its ass to get completely carbon free. And he's standing there saying, we've got to do a better job. And if I'm the German people, I'm looking at him going, what do you mean we?
Well, didn't
you've
he say
got to
that,
do a better job.
But didn't, was this another speech? Or did he say in that speech about how the U.S. is playing catch up? He did say that, didn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that was the only concession to what Germany has done, right?
Right. Acknowledging that they're just, I mean, they're so far out in front of us, we can't see them. We can't see
yeah.
the dust cloud they're kicking up.
No, but see, but you can't, I mean, it's just BS, because in the same minute, I don't know if you saw that article from the climate section of Think Progress, but he's whining about the dial meter went going down when he was talking about climate change in his State of the Union.
Yeah, the ho-hum factor.
It was just pathetic. I'm like, oh, wait a minute. That dial shit is just, a sort of trick for the networks. And the fact that he would, be so feckless about that. I don't know. I'm not feeling very encouraged. Let's just say that.
Well, I'm not either, and for a variety of reasons. We can sit here and play that parlor game of what would Obama be if he didn't have to deal with these frankly lunatics in the House of Representatives and the minority that's running the Senate. And it's a fun parlor game, unless you come to the conclusion that the man is essentially co-opted into the corporate superstructure now. And so if there's no money to be had in it, then it ain't interesting. You know, one of the things that strikes me about the German model, the Energiewende, is that it has opened up energy production to, ground level. Oh God, I hate it when I'm afraid I'm going to start sounding like some MBA critter. But it's opened up ground-level entrepreneurship for energy production to just everyday run-of-the-mill Germans. If let's say you've got an asparagus farm in Westphalia, well, your barns all have solar panels on them, and you are a net energy producer onto the grid, and it makes money for you.
Right, and that's because German policy engineered it so, laws were passed to make that possible. I mean, they're not feeding billions of dollars to the fossil fuel industry. They're not using their tax dollars to support that. They've made a conscious decision to turn their limited tax dollars to this business that you're talking about. You see, it isn't some sort of magic of the marketplace. Not until the government decides it is.
Right, and the one single thing that helped transform the German experiment is that law they passed. It's called a feed-in tariff, and it places a premium on locally small ownership produced energy over that produced by giant corporate conglomerates.
Right,
that's what makes it feasible. Can you imagine even trying to pass one of those damn things here?
That's what I mean. I'm just saying, it's just. The everything is captured here, all agencies, and something like this TPP is just gonna make that exponential. I mean, it's interesting because in Australia, they've opted out of these investor right bullshit. The what's the woman's name who's the Prime Minister of Australia?
Oh,
Gillard. she made a point of saying, no, we're not going to turn our sovereignty over to investor tribunals. And, you know, other countries are also stepping back with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a point where it could possibly fall apart. But here's the kicker. She may lose the election in September. If she loses the election in September, the coalition government already said that the investor rights is going to be probably brought back on a case-by-case. You see what I'm saying? See
right,
how that
and
works?
And that the carbon tax is in jeopardy.
Right, right. So, you know, that's a bit, you know, it's all, you know, it's all in play, because, you know, we really should just sort of, you know, even stop talking about the TPP and just move to fast track, because that is the only point where we can have any influence on this, is to, push the Congress to not okay or renew, because fast track was let expired in 2007, and Obama hasn't pushed, but he's now pushing to bring it back. Because if he has fast track, then he can just force the Congress to go up or down, no amendments, nothing, on the two agreements that they're working on, the one in Europe and the TPP thing. The one in Europe has come up against some pretty big snags, so that looks like it might be falling apart.
And yet we've got to, tell me if I've got this right. Our best hope that we could, of defeating the TPP resides with the Republicans, who will simply oppose anything that Barack Obama does.
Well, that was my next thing. I mean, I know it sounds crazy, but you know, I'm more than happy to call my Republican representatives and throw it out there like that. I don't care. And that could be another thing to push, you know, for progressives, is to take that tack. And, you know, progressives need to stop pussyfooting around and just play as nasty as everybody else does, because however you can stop this thing, much like the grand bargain, nothing happens because they hate Obama. Well, if that can work for us in this situation, then that's a victory. And there's a lot of people who aren't, there's a little bit squeamish about fast track coming back. So, you know, we'll see. We'll see.
Well, you know, it seems like the motto of fast track ought to be act in haste, repent in leisure. I mean, that's what it is. We get in a hurry, and then.
Yeah, I mean, but it's a horrible provision that has to not happen, because the TPP agreement is it's just going to be shock. It's going to be an economic shock, and it's just going to be outrageous going forward, because if they get it, if they pass it, then it's going to be open for any country to join, and they have to join just as it is. So it is truly an agreement that is, I don't know, can change the course of, you know, how we are going forward as industrial. I don't know. I don't even know how to. I mean, it's so massive. I can hardly come up with the words for the changes that are going to, you know, occur.
Well, did you see
it
the other day where the EPA is wimping out on drawing the bright line between fracking and water pollution? What is it, in Montana or Wyoming?
Yeah. I mean, and it's an outrage, because you would think that water is self-evident and it should be easy to protect, but it's not. And you have whole legislative bodies who don't know, don't want to know what is happening to their water. I mean, it's amazing.
But as someone who lives somewhere where water has been or water pollution has been at a critical stage for quite some time, you know, I can tell people, Sandra, that this stuff has real world consequences. Among other things, it may not sound like much, but when your family's been getting water clean, crystal clear, pure, wonderful water out of a well for generations, and then they blow up the mountain a couple of miles down the road, and suddenly your water becomes foul and tainted and poisonous, and the only remedy is to have to drag the bastards through court in a process that goes on for years. And then the ultimate outcome of that is that they put in a public water project and hand you a monthly water bill. That is no remedy, and it's no relief. I mean, there's a big difference between paying $100 a month for so-called city water and just having it come bubbling out of the ground for free.
Well, I mean, I just don't understand how people don't understand what a finite resource it is, you know?
It
ain't coming back.
No. And once, you know, it's like I started the program when Kate sent that note about what's going on up in Calgary. That's shocking. You know, 75,000 people evacuated today because Calgary, Alberta, Canada is under 10 feet of freaking raging floodwaters. And you couple that with the massive toxic pipeline spill that happened also in Alberta, that was not told, that the oil company didn't even tell anybody about until June the 12th, where 9.5 million liters of heavy metal laden poisoned water was dumped into a watershed. Well, where do you reckon all that water goes? Is some of that flowing through Calgary now?
Yeah, I mean, it's,
I mean,
yeah,
doesn't
exactly.
That just make your eyes roll back in your head?
Well, I was wondering when you were talking about Calgary, I'm like, well, okay, is this one of those 1,000-year floods? Have they ever had floods like this? I mean, do we know?
Yeah, well, I'll take it a step further, Sandra. Is there any such thing as a 1,000-year flood anymore?
Well, that would be what happened. I mean, what was I was reading the last time they had this sort of flooding in Central Europe was 1501.
Wow.
And so that's what's going on over there. And so that's why I said 1,000-year, because that's what they're talking about with Central Europe right now. This flooding that is, they've never seen, you know, it's been a while, okay?
Right, and then, you know, I mentioned it in the same breath, but the monsoon came early to the Indian subcontinent.
Well, that can't be good.
Well, no, it's not.
You know, that has to be, yeah, I mean, you know, if you mess with the whole monsoon stuff,
and
I mean,
the Himalayan glaciation is melting, and I don't mean because it's summer.
Yeah, no, I mean, what is the percentage of the Arctic sea loss since 80? Isn't it like 50 or 60%?
Oh, gee, the ice, yeah, geez, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so let me just ask you something. Do people expect that? That's not going to come back. It's not going to come back. And who knows? I mean, I don't understand how people can't appreciate. You have the top of the world, the world's cooling system, for any lack of other way of describing it, with a reduction of over half of all of its in volume lost in 30 odd years. How long did it take for that ice cap to be created, Bob?
Well, see, it was there before the glaciations were. I mean,
well, see, okay, so
been a while.
You know, I know, and then,
well, I mean, they drill, and it's one of those things that I point to from time to time because I'm just fascinated by it. But they've drilled ice cores in Greenland, okay, and from those ice cores, they can see carbon in the ice from when the Romans were deforesting Spain because they were smelting all the silver that they got when Carthage collapsed. Now, that's 200 years BCE, and you can see it in an ice core.
Well, no, there's this one lake somewhere in Siberia. I forget. I can't pronounce the name.
Baikal.
Don't ask me. No, it starts with an E. It's a really long word. But they have a group there, you know, that have, like, drilled cores just millions and millions and millions of years. You know, just,
yes.
I don't know, just so long ago. You know, where they were able to match levels of methane and CO2 and what was going on the planet when you had levels that we have now. Because there's a lag. I don't know if people realize there's a lag. So what they were talking about was going on Earth when you had 400 to 600 parts per million. It ain't nothing nice.
No.
it's not fit for us to live in. And see, we're replicating that right now. I don't know if you saw, but the methane level is up to 1,800 parts per billion. And that's unprecedented.
Jesus.
And they're saying that
we're
so screwed. Well, I think these positive feedback loops are really disturbing. I just read the other day that they said, "Oh snap! There's a huge methane plume right on the East Coast in the Atlantic that they just discovered."
Just landed. Just came here from outer space. Just fell through the atmosphere. We had nothing to do with it. And that's the problem, no. Sandra, because you've got all these people who are paid not to believe something or not to know something. There's that word believe, and you know how I feel about that. And they say, oh, what, Calgary's under 10 feet of water? Well, you know, these things happen.
Well, see, that's the thing, and that's what they're always trying to, they always run that out. And you're supposed to just nod your head and think, oh, I guess so. But all you got to do in this internet age is look around. For example, how is it 90 degrees in parts of Alaska? It's been so hot up there. They've never had temperatures that hot. There's no record of it.
Well, and that's the thing with Obama in Berlin standing in front of the Brandenburg Gate. It was blazing. And again, Berlin occupies a latitudinal position roughly equivalent to that of Alaska. I mean, not to go back into one of my tired old travel stories, but, you know, that 3 weeks or so that I spent in Germany had a profound impact on me because I was there on the 23rd day of May, and it was 90 degrees in a little town not far from Munster, which, you know, on a parallel, you know, just a few miles from the Dutch border, 90 degrees in May. And I asked my kind and genial host, I said, is it always like this? No, this is very strange, Bob. This is not right.
Well, I mean, they're getting temperatures up in parts of Alaska that right now should be about... the top would be 40 degrees, and it's 70. You know, I mean, just crazy. Well,
there's one other thing I wanted to mention. With the melting of the Arctic ice cap, people like us, we see that and go, shit, that's not good. This is a problem. But what do the people who are obsessed with wealth look at it and say?
And shipping lanes and how they can drill.
Yeah, we're going to go drill.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really...
We're going to go drill for some more of the stuff that made the ice cap melt in the first place because, you know, F it. Let's get our money and enjoy it while we may.
Well, you know, but you don't get 93 degrees in Prince William Sound. It was like 87 in Valdez, and I've been to Valdez in the summer, in the 80s. Trust me, it's not supposed to be that hot, okay?
Yeah, what happens when they start, you're in trouble when you're at Point Barrow and they're swapping out their snowmobiles for jet skis.
Well, no, that's already, I saw a video on how parts of Norway is warming up so much that they cannot use their snowmobile during the time of year that they have for generations. That's happening right now. It's slush, so they can't just ride over it. And, I don't mean to keep dropping in places I've been, but I've been to Lapland. I was there in February in the late 80s. And all we did was ride snowmobiles because everything was frozen shut. But that same area now, it's not as slushy. I don't know how else.
No, because I've seen, Travel Channel or whatever. You know, I saw something about, what was it, the northernmost McDonald's on the planet, and it was somewhere in Scandinavia, and everybody rode their snowmobiles through the snowmobile drive-through No. Mm. Then that's the way it's supposed to be.
Right, but I'm just saying in parts of Norway where that lifestyle has been that way forever, you know, they interviewed young people saying, well, no, it's not that way anymore, and, you know, that kind of stuff, which is really, you know, it's just a bit disturbing. And, you know, I don't need to hear about 80-degree weather at the top of the world in June.
No, and bear in mind, we're sitting here talking about the Arctic conditions. It's not like it's much better in the Antarctic.
Well, didn't they just NASA just released a report saying, oh, we didn't know that it was all melting underneath.
Yeah.
So that's what they discovered, that there's a severe amount of melting happening because of the push of warm water that's coming. And the kind of melting they're talking about is what keeps the ice sheet from just sliding into the ocean, Bob. I can't even wrap my head around it. It's so out of this world.
God almighty.
And, you know, and I mean, obviously I'm not talking about stuff that's happening overnight. I'm just saying when the ice sheet in Antarctica decides to slide in, what is that? 120-meter rise in ocean, apparently.
Yeah. Won't be any more basketball games in Miami.
No, you know, but I'm sorry. I don't even mean to be so cavalier about it, but it just boggles the mind because, you know, we're talking about ice-free Arctic in, you know, a couple, 3 years, apparently, not in 2040, or like they first thought, 2100. So how do we go from 2100 ice-free Arctic in the summer to 2016, Bob?
and see, the thing is, we don't really have any way of knowing, because like you said, you know, this stuff is cumulative. We don't really know when last 50 years. Let me see if I can even put this into words. If we stopped with every last bit of carbon into the atmosphere, if we stopped that tomorrow, are we past the point of no return?
Well, the climate commitment. I mean, that's what they call it.
Yeah.
What's baked in. You know, they don't know. They keep, you know, you have the International Energy Organization come up with different years, and they keep pushing everything forward as they start to realize what these positive feedback loops are doing, and, you know, it's all becoming nonlinear, and they're not too sure, you know, what to do. I know they're going to do another, what is that organization that does climate? IPCC, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Yeah, they have another one coming out, I think, in the fall. And they still haven't included the role of methane.
And you know, it was in the meeting that Obama had with the Chinese head man, where they started talking about the, what is it, hydrofluorocarbons, which was the stuff that replaced chlorofluorocarbons as the refrigerant in air conditioning units.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Because it turns out that that's rotting the atmosphere as badly as the CFCs did. So now they're in this now they got to, because in a warming planet, you're going to need air conditioning, right? So you're just in it. Screw yourself. It's what the whole loop looks like. Meanwhile, though, and you'll get a big giggle out of this, you know, you were talking about Valdez and Prince William Sound and things like that, you know, and it being roughly the same temperature there as it is at Myrtle Beach, South Carolina right now. Well, you know what Alaska's response to that is? Their governor signed his Stand Your Ground law into effect today.
Oh, you mean that's after reducing all the taxes on the fossil fuel companies up there. You know, it's just stunning. I mean, Alaskans at least were getting some money, and he enrolled back some of that. It's incredible. So now
everybody's going to be all gunned up. And
Exxon is going to be able to just drill away and not have to pay as much in dividends to the citizens. I mean, it's listen, I don't know who these, I don't know how these people get elected, but I guess I do. They just get bought off.
Well, I think it goes past that. I think there's an assumption, right or wrong, and probably right, Sandra, that people in Alaska will say, well, you know, taxes is bad, but look here, we can stand our ground now.
Yeah, well, I don't, you know, I was just sort of amazed.
And so everybody's going to be gunned, because remember, Alaska's one of those places that cannot support itself. And so everybody's going to be all gunned up when the food riots start.
I mean, yeah, no, Alaska is a trip anyway. You know, I was forever freaked out when I was up there. But anyway, that's for another day. I have to mention that the whole, it was like, oopsie, in Brazil.
God. That just keeps getting more interesting, doesn't it?
Well, what's interesting, though, is, you know, how these things start. Now, in China, if you want to get on a bus, you can pay 33 cents, but in Rio they try to charge you $2. What's the problem? In China, them people know, like Hyatt said, you cannot subject the environment or transportation to the competitive principle. Hyatt said that.
Jesus.
Hyatt. Okay, now if that motherfucker knows what is going to set people off, what happened to them elites in Brazil?
Well, and remember, Brazil was going to be this brave new world state because they had, Da Silva for a while, and he's a socialist. Well, again, like you said, oopsie. I mean, a million and a half people in 80 cities protesting last night?
Well, the problem is, I mean, you know, Brazil has always been, the inequality is just staggering, but apparently, you know, it was just one, you know, just a bit too much, and the people are really sick of the elites, like, left and right, you know, working folks are just sick of them. Also, these sort of neoliberal pageantries that are all coming to Brazil, it's just not playing that well, because they are screwing the people over to bring this shit. I mean, once again, Brazil is a huge economy and it's, you know, developing really quickly. But I don't know who tells these countries that it's a good idea to hold these neoliberal parades and parties, because obviously the people aren't going to put up with that kind of expenditure when they are starving and they can't get health care and they can't catch a goddamn bus to work.
Well, a long time back, there was a book written called The Great American Job Scam, and it talked about the pervasive nature of this race to the bottom, where it's all about, yeah, but it'll be good for the economy. And that's all they have to say. It's like a magic, some sort of magic talisman. It'll bring jobs. It'll be good for the economy. When in fact, none of these parties, these spectacles, these circuses, are ever long-term net good for the economy. I mean, I love this sign. Brazil squared off in a soccer match against Mexico, and so they protested at the game, Sandra.
Yeah, they surround. I mean, apparently it was more people protesting on the outside than could be held in those stadiums. And you know what's worse?
They had signs inside the stadium, and what's wild is that, for instance, you know, with FIFA, you know, the international body that governs soccer,
they're really doing themselves. I mean, keep talking. That's all I have to say to that guy. Yeah, unbelievable.
But they've got these standards that they impose anywhere that they have one of these big shebangs, about the quality of this and the quality of that, and they're called FIFA standards. And one of the things that they have is a standard for the quality of health care available to, to the athletes, et cetera, injuries, whatnot. So lo and behold, they're inside the stadium. The fans are inside the stadium with signs that say, we want hospitals FIFA standard in Brazil.
Well, do you know that FIFA has threatened to sue Brazil?
What?
That's the latest thing I read. So they're going to sue them for loss of profits or whatever is going on if they can't get the rabble in check, because they're going to have their event. So it's nasty. I mean, I kind of thought when they got the Olympics, I thought, well, what are they going to do with all those people? And it looks like they don't know what the hell they're doing, because the people look to be kind of upset.
And rightly so. And I don't, and barring some sort of concession, I don't know what's going to make them happy. And
well,
I don't say that from a point of being critical, but what makes this go away?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, different organizations have sort of, you know, jumped in. I think there's a couple of anti-corruption parties. All this is out of the middle classes now. So, I mean, it's a really broad spectrum of people. So I'm not too sure what is going to be the outcome. But, I can't think of a goddamn thing that would get a million Americans out like this, though. I'll tell you that.
The cable going out.
I guess, but you know.
I lived through that derecho bullshit last summer, and we're kind of, you know, one of those things blew through a couple of weeks ago, and everybody in this state was just sitting with their with their butts all puckered up, waiting for the shit to hit the fan because, well, our electrical infrastructure is basically strung through forests on toothpicks, and it's not worth a damn. And, you know, the next one will probably put us out for 3 weeks.
Right, and you know, we see how they, yeah, no, it's all, I don't know, I'm just sort of tripping, because you had Turkey, and now you have this, it's just globally not a very happy lot right now.
No, and anywhere, you might be fascinated with this story, because it's a non-story. It's not out there in the larger... This will be the only place you'll hear about it. But not too far from here, a coal company donated a toxic waste site, you know, a former strip mine, to the Boy Scouts of America. And the Boy Scouts of America, in turn, went out to outfits like Bechtel, and Bechtel gave them googly millions of dollars to build this Boy Scout Jamboree complex over there. Again, not at all far. It's right here in my home county, not far from here. It's across the New River, you know, maybe 10, 15 miles. And so they have worked, and they have worked, and they've worked, and they've made this massive Boy Scout Jamboree complex that's going to host, you know, tens of thousands of people at one time, Boy Scouts. Among other things, nature is not taking too kindly to it, because they're hauling something like 100 rattlesnakes a day off the site.
Oh, my God.
Guys is just crawling with them. But, and this is the story, there's a little worn-out, tired old coal town nearest the campsite called Mount Hope, West Virginia, Sam. And it's a ghost town. It used to have millions of dollars flowing through it in the form of coal. Well, I was talking to somebody last night, and they were telling me what's going on over there. Mount Hope probably has the highest concentration of persons of color in this county. West Virginia is still a very, very white place.
Mm-hmm.
And our communities of color tend to be non-rural. They're in these little communities and quite often accompanied by urban poverty. Well, Mount Hope is one such place, and it is being depopulated. The money people have come in and bought up all the homes that poor folks are living in, pulled out of agreements with HUD, Section 8, that kind of stuff, and black folks are being basically cleansed out of Mount Hope, West Virginia, to keep the Boy Scouts happy.
Oh, my God.
Not kidding.
Wow. Sounds like the Fillmore District in San Francisco.
Yeah.
I hear what you're saying.
You know, it's kind of hard to think of gentrification in terms of something like a worn-out old coal ghost town. But sure enough, you know, and they're doing it under the guise of, well, you know, we're clearing the area of drugs.
Oh no! Wow.
You know, making the area safe for the little Eagle Scouts to be.
Incredible. Well, I mean that, you know, I mean that seems to be the future, though, is to, I mean, people need to be gotten rid of, I guess.
Well, look, we're talking about climate change and everything. Who's going to be the first to go when the oligarchs need some high ground to get on, Sandra?
Well, yeah.
The highest, I made the joke about, you said 120-foot sea level rise, and I made a joke about no more basketball in Miami. Well, the fact of the matter is the highest ground in the Miami area is presently an area that is not considered to be the best part of the city.
Mm.
Well, it'll become the best part of the city, and the people who are living there will be displaced. I mean,
right.
Look at the depopulation of New Orleans since Katrina.
Oh yeah, no, that's it right there. I mean, that's your shock doctrine right in front of us, completely
right in the teeth,
including and not limited to privatized public schools. They're all privatized. You know, I mean, New Orleans. It's just outrageous.
I mean, I know it's one of those simpleton. Pop culture stories, but this Paula Deen business.
Oh, wow. Yeah, now she apologized, didn't she?
Yeah,
her money ain't gonna be right. That's the only reason why she apologized.
Right, and because when she first took to the air, there was this story of this gritty, determined woman who had been left by her husband to raise some young boys, and you know, she didn't know how she was going to get by, and she was just going to cook like Mama taught her to cook. And, you know, she turned into an institution. She's a walking profit center. And so now it comes out that she is a vile, nasty, I mean, it's like she's a member of the Klan Ladies Auxiliary or something.
What did someone say? She's like a racist white lady out of Central Casting.
Yes!
Yeah.
And yet, there are people out there. Well, I don't see what the problem is.
Well, unfortunately, there's black people out there too, who still like her.
And I was thinking, I was thinking about that trip I made down to Mississippi a few years back, and we stayed in one of the casino hotels, and across the way, the main casino, Harrah's, there had Paula Deen Southern Buffet, and Toby Keith's I Love This Bar American Roadhouse. Talk about a double whammy of just crappy culture. I just wonder if Paula Deen's Southern Home Cooking Cafe is still drawing them in down in Tunica.
Well, did you see the, I don't know if you had a chance, but that it was a whole sort of hashtag of Paula Deen's best dishes.
Oh God, I saw that.
Some of them was just heck of funny. Oh my God. But anyway, yeah, I was like, cause what she said was just so over the top. I'm like, oh my God.
I just wish we could dress them up like, like they used to do in the Shirley Temple movies.
Right.
And
it had to be a certain age, like all of them, like, you know, Morgan Freeman type age. Yeah, no, the whole thing was just warped as hell.
And now Food Network has bid her adieu. They will not renew. Not going to renew her contract. That's why she did the apologizing.
That's the thing. That's what I mean. That's the only reason is, was messing with her money. Because, someone like that there's no redeeming that. That's just needs to shut the hell up. The fact that she felt okay not shutting up, that's her loss. Bye-bye.
Yeah, but, it turns out Tony Bourdain was right all along. Remember when she announced that she had diabetes and then immediately launched her diabetic foods?
Right.
Line and Bourdain tweeted, if somebody cut off her leg, she'd go into the crutch business.
Not only that, but didn't she drop a few, you know, drop a few pounds? I mean, listen, that money, you know, but it sounds like she kind of effed up big time now. So we'll see. These people, there's always a second act in America for certain people, right?
And those people usually have their, have bank books that are measured in six or seven digits.
Well, except there may not be a second act for that freak at the Patriots.
Oh, no, that's ugly.
They got Tim Tebow, and that organization is falling apart. Putin must have put a curse on their ass. He didn't only just take a goddamn ring. That story is hilarious.
Oh, I can't wait for Tebow mania to get into full swing there.
Oh, no, but the whole thing is, I mean, it's like, what are they got some dude who was blowing up people in the back of the head? I mean, that shit sound crazy.
Oh, no, that's...
You know?
But again, there's stuff that the NFL won't tolerate, and there's stuff that the NFL will tolerate.
No, but apparently this dude, when he was in Florida, was a straight-up gangster. So, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. It's not like they didn't have reason.
Yeah, he was involved when someone else got shot up down there. So, I don't know all the details of this, but it just sounds, when I heard that the man that was murdered was like shot execution style in the back of the head, I'm like, oh man.
Yeah, Bill Bellett, the hoodie is having a hissy.
Oh, he's having a problem, but then he shouldn't have. You know, well, first of all, when the Putin story came out, I mean, it just all went downhill from that. And they got to Tim Tebow, and I'm like, why in the world would the Patriots bring that circus to their organization?
Because their offensive coordinator is the idiot who drafted him in Denver.
Oh, is that horrible Josh McDaniels back there?
Yes.
Shut up. I didn't realize. Oh, okay. Well, it's amateur hour then. What is Bill Belichick? Got another wife on the go. He don't know what the hell he's doing. What's happening? Is there some problem? Yeah, nah, see, I don't like the Patriots, so I think this is hysterical. The whole meltdown. Anyway.
I love the Putin story. My God.
Oh, God.
You know, he's an old KGB spook. He just slipped it right off of Kraft's finger, and there you go. You know.
Oh, and then ran away. The fucking State Department and the White House had to get involved because that Kraft was stamping up and down. I want it back. I want it back. Anyway, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
it's
I know.
Just like these nasty ass people. That just sounded hilarious. That man is out of control, and he's on the market. Him and Rupert Murdoch, they both back on the market.
Oh, man.
Ladies.
don't miss this opportunity.
Exactly.
I don't even my mind does not want to even begin to contemplate what a night with Pootie Poot must be all about.
Well, it might be a little bit more amusing than with Dick gone, that can't be good at all. Murdoch, hence Blair, and whoever else that bitch was going around with.
Good God.
Tony Blair trying to say, oh, no, it wasn't me. Please. Have you seen her? She's pretty fine. So
and you wonder all along, you know, why? Except, well, then you go, bank book.
Something, but, you know, for him to file divorce at his age, she must have humiliated his ass beyond belief.
And there must be one Jim Dandy prenup somewhere in somebody's coat pocket.
No, but Tony Blair, it's like, you know that shit is true. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You know it's true.
Sure, sure. and of course, and just one last little bit of salacious gossip coming out of the hills and hollers here. You know, last year while we were frying in the post-derecho blackout, no electricity, they were having their magnificent golf tournament down at the Greenbrier,
right. That's right.
Where all the
right.
National Guard and all the ice and all the generators and everything were. And the big draw there was, you know, Tiger Woods is coming. Tiger Woods is going to be playing at the blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. Well, guess what? Tiger ain't coming back this year. And, you know, the way I wonder why that would be. Does he hate West Virginia? No, it may turn out that that man's got a shred of integrity. Because Jim Justice, who is a coal billionaire, who turns out to be, by the way, a deadbeat for paying his bills, his coal companies are like getting sued by everybody under the sun because he won't pay the coal company's bills to these contractors and providers. But he's pals with Chris Klein because all these coal billionaires, they rub shoulders and think that they're somebody because they got a lot of money. And Chris Klein is the guy who's been swanning around with Tiger's ex, Elon.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I did see. Yeah, exactly.
So,
okay.
You know, I heard that Tiger's not showing up for this big hoop-de-doo, and I'm thinking, well, I bet I know why. You don't necessarily just want to be wandering, walking down the fifth fairway and see Elon, hanging around all over some sickening coal billionaire.
Oh, God.
I don't know if she's still seeing him or not, but I seriously call her integrity into question. I mean,
hey, you know, why would she, why would these people give it? They don't give an F about what coal is doing to the masses.
No, we're just little people. We're just
just little people. Listen, I guess I'll let you go. But did you know, and I didn't know this, that potato prices in Ireland are up 213%
Jesus.
compared with April of 2012? What's that about?
I don't know.
I know. And you think it's in Ireland, and you think, well, potatoes, Ireland. Oh, God. You know what I mean? It's not exactly a pleasant relationship.
Right. Ireland, potato, and the next word is famine.
And on top of that, the British, we know they caused that one. But what I'm saying, though, is that how bizarre that the prices are so I didn't really get into it to find out what were the factors, but that's a huge jump year over year,
it's monumental.
Anyway,
and we're going to see breaking news before you go. Edward Snowden has now been officially charged with violating the Espionage Act and theft of government property.
You know what? Of course they're going to have to go completely overboard. Well, I think these various Greenwald and him other journalists, they better watch their asses because espionage.
Yeah, that's...
That sounds like it can be a bit of a dragnet if they're going that heavy on it. And that homeboy, he going to turn this all into some sort of international incident because don't you think that the various players are thinking, how can we use this fool in China and whatnot? Get the popcorn.
Yeah, I mean, if you were China, wouldn't you?
Well, I'd be thinking, everything's geopolitical. So we'll see how this plays out.
But
he should have took his ass to Ecuador or Iceland from the get-go.
Yep, and I guess his excuse was he was afraid he'd be picked up somewhere on the way, so he just flew straight to China.
I guess. Well, people should make better plans because I definitely would have went to a country. The extradition would have been first on my list. I mean, I don't blame him for wanting to be away from the U.S. when all that went down, considering what happens to whistleblowers under the Obama administration. But I think I would have made sure I was in some sense. They didn't know where I was before I dropped the bomb. I would have gone to an Iceland or Ecuador or some other, Malaysia, some other country where the extradition isn't so cut and dry.
Well,
although Hong Kong, it's not that cut and dry.
It's not cut and dry because Hong Kong has they have an extradition treaty with the U.S., but it contains an exception for political offenses.
Right.
And so if he raises the political offense defense, the extradition may become quite ugly.
And I'm sure with most extradition, there's like 90-day or 60-day window or some day window where the person being asked for can, petition some court. So, but espionage, man. Wow.
Yeah. And so this thing's going to blow up all over the place, and it has not been handled well.
No, but we still, you know, the spying is one thing, but I love how the media isn't talking about the complete outsourcing of our intelligence services.
That's the story, Sandra.
That's a huge story, and it's a very
very, very particularly, how does a guy who couldn't get out of high school, who couldn't get out of community college, who couldn't finish college, who couldn't finish a hitch in the military, who wound up being a security guard, wind up making anywhere between $100,000 and $200,000 a year as a so-called analyst? How does that happen?
It happens.
What's the vetting process?
Well, there is no, because you know what it is. It's another wealth transfer scheme, and they needed to keep it secret because then they would have to explain why Booz Allen makes all their money, 95% of it, from spying on us and charging the government for it.
Right.
I mean, you think about it. It's a really disturbing model, and you know, that's the story. I think that the privatization of the security apparatus is a massive story.
Think about the way that law firm billing works. You're the top partner, so you're billing at $1,200 an hour. You're having a guy do the work for you that is billing at $125 an hour, but you're billing his work as yours. So everything above $125 an hour is gravy.
Mm.
Well, the same thing probably happened with Snowden and however many thousands upon tens of thousands there are like him, where
right.
You may be paying the guy $100 to $200 a year.
Yeah, but you're charging five times.
Yeah, you're billing him at $1,000,005.
$1,000,000, yeah, no. I mean, but the thing is, the whole mechanism is just so outrageous because what lengths are these private actors going to go to keep that money coming? It's really disturbing. We're talking war. We're talking all sorts of society-destroying activities to keep these people in money. These are things that the government should be doing, not private corporations. And the whole Google, Facebook, all them people, they're not giving the government data. They're being paid for this data.
You're damn right.
And
see,
so
and that's another layer of that. People say,
right.
Oh, the government's spying on you. Oh, the government's spying on you. Well, Sandra, you and I have been having a conversation for years now about the fact that all of our data, you know, because we use these things, because it's become ubiquitous in our lives, we're doing nothing but generating data for the Googles and the Facebooks and the Twitters to profitize.
Right, and they're more than happy to, you know, they're scrambling. I think one interesting thing that's hilarious is Google is scrambling because GoDuckGo is another search engine that has, like, you know, quadruple in their traffic over the last week and a half. So, you know, this stuff is a problem for these corporations because a lot of people are like, well, shit, I don't want to use this service if they're turning over everything to the government. And GoDuckGo has a different algorithm that apparently isn't as intrusive and very prone for the kind of data mining that you get with a Google or a Facebook.
Right,
so,
and all these, you know, and I understand the concerns of people who say that they're worried about the government spying on us. But the government, there are at least theoretical checks on government, Sandra.
Well, not when it's when it's privatized to the tune of 70, 80, you know, when you have the privatized.
And that's the whole point I'm getting at. You have no recourse, none, zero. Against a Google or a Facebook or a Yahoo or an AOL or what, you have no recourse. You can go and file the suit and it'll be dismissed before you get home because there's no recourse to them. And there's nothing There's absolutely nothing to because the Constitution, the Bill of Rights does not apply to Google. Just like
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I just Well, at any rate,
I mean,
this
kind of stuff is, I guess what I'm saying, this kind of stuff has been going on for years. Anybody who has ever been burned by a shitty credit report, well, that just goes back to the time when data was mined physically by human beings. But now, now it's, you know, there's three primary credit reporting agencies, and if one of them decides that they don't like you, you're screwed.
Oh yeah, no. It's it's already way out of control. But I give credit to this story breaking because a lot of people that I know who never gave it two thoughts are like giving it some thought. So I don't see the downside to that for the population at large. I see a downside for Snowden, but I don't know what to say about him. But having this discussion about it, I don't think it's
I think it's long overdue. This is a discussion we should have been having in 2006.
Well, right. No, it's been going on and on. And I've discovered, like I said, I discovered the whole privatization of the security state, in a foreign policy class when I was doing my undergraduate, and I was disturbed by it then, but that was years ago. So that's the story, and they're doing their best to try to bury it because that's the gravy train.
Yeah, and you know what? That contract's not going to be canceled. See,
no,
that's the one thing that's tucked away in here. All of these things with Booz Allen and that bunch are governed by contract. And the government can't just go breach the contract.
Well, not only that, but they've been, you've been hearing noise about trying to limit some of the secrets, and boy, are they already getting the pushback from the Booz Allens of the world and their lobbyists and their... So, no one's going to give up that gravy train very easily. Nice story about the FBI... Oh, well, do we use drones to spy on it? Well, kind of, but not that much. Did you catch all that?
No.
The FBI, the guy was testifying, and he admitted that they're already using drones to surveil, people in this country. But he said it's really not that much.
Well, we know, for instance, that drones have been used, and frankly, I can't get too all fired worked up about it. Because remember the right wing having a hissy some months back because allegedly the EPA was going to use drones to overfly some of these toxic agriculture sites like CAFOs and whatnot. I'm okay with that, and not because I'm into domestic spying, but because these people. I mean, the West Texas fertilizer explosion, the refinery explosion in Louisiana. These are places that haven't been inspected by OSHA in 20 damn years.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, and, that story just came and went. I mean, how many people got injured there?
Yeah.
In that explosion in...
And the weird part, in Texas, apparently FEMA told them to go pound sand.
Oh, no. That was... Wow, yeah. I don't even know what to say about that. That is terrible. But it's also Texas.
Right. I mean, how do you, if you're Rick Perry, how do you complain about that? You're Rick Perry.
Well,
you hate FEMA.
Well, speaking of Texas right quick, though, I see some women are kind of upset. Did you see that?
Yeah, that's been beautiful. I've been following that via Beth in Texas, who's been posting stuff on my Facebook page. Here's Facebook.
Mm.
It's gotten real cranky. And
no,
for good
but,
reason.
No, and for good reason. The sort of hatred that's spewing in North Carolina tells me that that's starting to get to them, that Monday protest every Monday. That's starting to be a problem. So I hope they keep it up.
Yeah, Ron wrote in from Raleigh right before showtime. I don't know if you read this or not, or read about it, but he pointed out that part of the things, one of the issues surrounding Moral Mondays that one right-wing freak complained of as being moron Monday. He really did say that. The new Republican legislature has now repealed the Racial Justice Act, which was put in place to review death penalty cases to see if racial bias existed in the prosecution or the sentencing. It has now been repealed. There haven't been any executions in North Carolina since 2006, and they'll probably crank right up now.
Well, listen, someone's here, so I gotta go, but have a good weekend.
Oh, you too. It's been a great conversation, Sandra. Thank you very much.
All right. All right. Take care.
Bye now. Bye. A wonderful Friday conversation with Sandra. We will keep things going. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, good afternoon, Bob.
Hey, Kevin, how are you?
Long time no talk to.
Been a little while.
Yeah. Glad to see you back in the friendly confines of the mansion there.
It depends on your definition of friendly, but yeah, it's nice to be home.
Yeah. So I just called because I've been listening all week, and I thought about calling in a couple times, but I really enjoyed listening to most of the calls. And one of the things I wanted to mention was Larry had mentioned his troubles last week with the home health care situation out there in California. And I just wanted to comment that what they're trying to do, as I understand it, is to privatize that system, and instead of it being run by the state, it would be run for a for-profit corporation, which is why he mentioned the unions, and the unions, he felt like the unions weren't speaking out enough or whatever. Well, that's what they do. They're playing off, you know, it's the old, same old story. They're playing off the unions against each other, essentially, but you know, they're making the unions look like the bad guys when it's not the union's fault, it's not the leadership's fault. It all comes down to the fact that they want to privatize this home health care situation and turn it into the hands of a corporation instead of running it as it should be ran, you know, as part of the government, because it really isn't a for-profit business to begin with, what you're doing.
Right.
It can be, but then the quality of care goes down if the company that you happen to get doesn't make quality of care the first issue. And I know out here we've got private corporations, but it's still ran by the government. So, you know, we have some oversight, we have some rules they have to follow and that kind of thing. We have, I have someone from, and I don't even mind probably as much as Larry, but with my home health care person, the person from the state calls about once a month, every 2 months, just to check to make sure I'm happy with everything, find out how I'm doing. She'll come out to do a home visit every so often, you know, those kinds of things. And you know, so would I prefer that it all be done by the government? Probably, because then you have one continuum of care. You're not passing it off to somebody else and overseeing them. You're actually doing it yourself. But no, I understand where he's coming from, but I had to mention that it's one of the things that aggravates me is they tend to do a lot of this where they try to make the unions look like the bad guys, and it's really the corporations that are the bad guys. And you know, that's where the fight needs to be fought, is no, we don't want the corporations.
Well, you know, it's another piece in the ongoing puzzle, if you will, Kevin, of the the corporatization of the idea, the very idea of government. What Sandra was talking about with national security being farmed out to these goons, what you're describing here. And I think Exhibit A in how bad it can get is the fact that Mississippi, for God's sakes, just fired Corrections Corporation of America that was running one of its ungodly hellhole prisons. They fired them because of the way they were running it. It was bestial. CCA also ran a prison in Idaho that was referred to by the inmates there as Gladiator School. I mean, cases of overbilling, fraud, you know, everything to maximize profits and minimize costs. And this country hasn't come to the same conclusion that the Horn family commune has come to a long time since, that there are just some parts of life that should not be made subject to the profit motive. You know, if you're in national security to make a profit, if you're running prisons to make a profit, hell, if you're providing the local public water supply to make a profit, it ain't gonna work. And it really is that simple, isn't it?
Yes, because anybody that's wanting to make a profit is going to try to cut costs. It's just a fact of life. They're going to find out the way to make profit. They're not in business to do anything but make profit. CCA, we fired here in Colorado a couple years ago because of the same problems. And, you know, I think it got through to some of the people's heads out here in Colorado that that's not something you can farm out and make do with a private corporation. It's got to be run by the state, both for the safety of the inmates and of the guards and corrections officers. And, you know, why would you want it to be ran for profit? What possible for profit can be done by running a prison? The only for profit out of that would be the problems that you just mentioned with the one up there. You know, the cutting of costs, the cutting of meals, the abuse of inmates, you know, so on and so forth. And I see a little hint every now and then that people are starting to catch on to some of this. I was impressed with the amount of Twitterverse activity last night on House Bill 60 and 16 in Texas, and the fact that there was so much outrage over it. I'm hoping that's the start of something. But, you know, the same question we've always had is, what will it take? What's the tipping point when people will start to do like they're doing down in Brazil? You know, it's nice to have a World Cup, but when you're spending godly amounts of money to do it, you know, at the expense.
Right, but what, you know, what is the... what's the takeaway? What good does it do? I mean, I think we get to ask those questions still in this world and in this country, don't we, Kevin? What good does it do?
Nothing. You'll hear when some team wants to build a new stadium or a city wants to get a Super Bowl, they talk about the amount of money, the jobs it'll create, the amount of money it'll bring into the city. And unless you happen to be in, like, the food service industry or the T-shirt industry, it doesn't bring anything into you. You know, there's a lot of people that are more adversely affected by a Super Bowl coming to their town than not. As far as what I've seen being in Tampa, the times they've had the Super Bowl, you know, it never brought any more job to me. It didn't increase my standard of living. It increased somebody's standard of living, probably the owner of the stadium, but aside from that, and the jobs it does create are temporary jobs, they're not lasting jobs, you know, and so, you know, the sell job they give you about bringing the World Cup down to Brazil, I fully understand why the Brazilians are upset, and, you know, you see, I forget what city it's in, but you see where, is it in New York next year, or Detroit, or where? It's a cold weather city, and they're already creating, starting to essentially ban the homeless, finding ways to get the homeless out of the city. And you'll see things like that happen, where we're not going to show the bad side of the city at all. We'll just get rid of the homeless. We'll either jail them or make life so unbearable for them that they'll go to another city. And, you know, it's just a joke.
Yeah, we'll cleanse it, right?
Yeah. And until the game's over.
Well, I mean, that's like the story I told to Sandra, Kevin. If it is in fact true that Mount Hope, West Virginia, I know it doesn't matter much in the grand scheme of things, but if you're being driven out because you are black and because we don't want to offend the nice white little Boy Scouts, well, it's a bigger story than most people know.
Yeah.
And it is a telling story about, the length to which we will go to make sure that a certain segment of the population are not inconvenienced or made to even look at people they do not wish to see. I mean, just let that one roll around for a little bit.
Well, these are Boy Scouts, by God. They don't need to be seeing any black people living in poverty or anything. God damn.
Right? I mean, does that make you a little sick?
Yeah, it makes me a little angry because it's 2013. I'm just amazed that we're still where we're at, and it's 2013. I thought we had at least moved past that level of racial prejudice, that we've got to cleanse a city so these Boy Scouts don't have to see black people or poverty. I think if I ran a Boy Scout troop, you know, the Boy Scouts have to do these various things during badges and that. I think that'd be one of the things I might want them to see and want them to help with. Let them see the poverty that other people live in and go out and try and help with that. And
I know it.
It's like I guarantee you we wouldn't be in the same place we are now politically if we didn't have a black man as president. There's certain people that have just gone. They call it Obama derangement syndrome. It's more like black derangement.
Well, syndrome. It's Clinton derangement syndrome with the added scintilla of force multiplier of the deep and abiding race hatred that still exists in this country. That's what it boils down to. Hey, Kevin, it's wonderful hearing from you. I hope you have a great weekend. I want to try to get a couple more calls in if I can. I really thank you for hanging on so we could talk a little bit.
All right, Bob, you have a good weekend, too.
All right, take care. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Kevin calling from Colorado Springs and onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, how are you this evening?
How are you, Jim?
Just okay. Just listening to some of the stuff that you've been discussing. Four of it, sixes and sevens, but nonetheless, I have no great solutions the way some people pretend to. But nonetheless, you know, as far as this number one, this thing about hope is concerned, what do you mean they're driving out black families?
What do you not understand about what I said?
What's your source on that?
I'm not at liberty to divulge that. It was in private conversation.
Okay. So basically what your source is telling you is basically what they did to Berlin in 1936 when they tried to clean up Berlin for 2 weeks for the Olympics, right?
And what has been done in a lot of cities ever since. Only usually it takes the form, like for instance, like with the inauguration, you start shuffling the homeless people out. Well, these aren't homeless people. These are folks that have lived there for quite some long time.
Well, what legal mechanism is being employed to do this?
Eviction? Arrest? Plain old-fashioned coercement and harassment?
Are you talking about drugs and stuff like that? Because I know that Dr. Linda last night mentioned what a serious drug problem there was in this part of West Virginia.
Well, that's part of the pretense that's attached to it, yes.
Well, with him, it was no pretense. He mentioned it as a matter of fact.
Yeah, and it is a fact. I mean, I was watching the news last night, and there was some bust down in one of the benighted southern counties, and you had a bunch of people, you know, holding their handcuffed hands over their faces, going into being arraigned over, you know, pill charges.
Well, that seems to be endemic here. I mean, you know, all types of drugs, whether they're pharmaceuticals or whether they're recreational drugs or whatever. So I don't know. I don't know that much about Mount Hope. I have a good friend who lives there. And oddly enough, she has not mentioned one thing about that to me. And we talk daily.
That does not negate, one does not negate the other, Jim.
Well, I'm just simply saying this person is very responsible. She's a school teacher and also works very closely with me with the Animal Protection League and stuff like that. She's extremely attuned to things that are going on in her neighborhood and this, that, and the other, and this is the first I've heard of it. But I think they will have more of a problem with rattlesnakes than they would with black people who live there. It would appear to me, though.
Yeah.
That would be a problem.
And it is apparently one snaky damn place up there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It is. It is indeed. And you were going on about Congress or about the Senate and this, that, and the other. And this is something I want to ask you if I can get a good answer on this. Whatever happened to Ashley Judd trying to run against that idiot from Kentucky?
Well, she bailed.
You know why?
One may only speculate. But she bailed after it was announced that McConnell had been having meetings in which they openly discussed how viciously they were going to slime her with excerpts from her autobiography when she talked about having had, you know, mental health issue treatments.
Yes, I'm aware of that. And, of course, who isn't in that body in Washington does have mental health treatment problems?
Right, but see, she had the candor to actually write about it and put it in print.
I've read her book, I know. And she's also an extremely qualified person as far as education is concerned.
Certainly, she's very, very intelligent. But the other part of it that may have played into it as well is the fact that her marriage to Dario Franchitti has ended or is in the process of ending. And anybody who's ever been through a divorce knows that there are no easy ones.
Well, there's some ramifications about that that I'm sure they could have probably used. But nonetheless, when I saw her in the film DeLovely, when she played Linda Lee Porter, the wife of Cole Porter, she played that role as well as any actress could ever play, considering the history of her relationship, Linda Lee Porter, played by Ashley Judd, with her husband. You know, it was just incredible what a wonderful job she did. She's a wonderful actress.
And she's a wonderful actress because she, A, has a lot of talent, and B, has a lot of brains. You know, there are a lot of people out there who think that that actors are just blank slates who have the magical ability to project someone else's reality. But it's brutally hard work. B, there aren't many people who are just drop-dead dumb who are really, really good at the acting game.
Well, for her to have played that role in that particular film, De Lovely, it took a great deal of introspection and a great deal of talent and a marvelous amount of intelligence for her to have done that. I don't know if you've seen the film De Lovely, but I recommend it highly.
I haven't seen it, but I'll try to check it out.
Well, yeah, well, I'm sure you will, but nonetheless. So what else is going on with you?
Oh, goodness me, just marching through the stories this evening, Jim. You obviously heard a little bit of the talk about food stamps, the SNAP program, and you know, cutting that. You know, the Republicans didn't think there was enough being cut out of it. You remember how Ronald Reagan created the myth of the welfare queen showing up in her Cadillac with a fur coat on, blah, blah, blah. You remember that, right?
Oh, I not only remember it, but I can remember, while living in South Carolina, being shown examples of it, you know, that type thing, yeah.
Well, there's been a new myth created.
What is that?
Louis Gohmert, who will never win the IQ award in the House of Representatives.
No, he will not.
Took to the floor because I guess he's feeling a little bit sensitive about the fact that his party is being portrayed, and I think rightfully so, as a bunch of heartless assholes for trying to balance the budget on the backs of hungry people.
Well, Bob, they've been trying to do that the past 30 years. They tried to balance the budget on the back of the federal worker, you know, and that type thing. It's just
yeah, they want to balance the budget on the backs of everybody except the people who have the backs to balance it on.
And the reason that they're doing this is because of the flow of money. And these initially when they started contracting, I mean, the government, particularly the military, for example, now they have to contract certain things out, like the airplanes and things like that, Northrop Grumman and things like that, because they don't have civil servants who have that expertise. That I can understand. But they still, and they should, or they used to have what they call quality assurance, or QA people, who would ensure that the contractor was living up to his standard of contract. And there were severe penalties for those contractors who did not. Now, I don't know what's happened to that. I haven't been in that game in a long time. Like I told you before, I used to be a contracting officer representative, and I know whereof I speak, as far as the legal ramifications of it, and as far as the fiduciary responsibilities of contractors to the government are. Now, if these have been removed, do you know of them being removed, or what?
No, I don't, but I can point to the... Specifically, no, Jim, but I can point to the fact that employment within the government is one sector of employment nationally that has taken a larger hit than just about any other single sector.
Well,
so is it safe to extrapolate from that that some contract oversight has probably gone by the wayside?
Well, I'm sure that the quality assurance people are no longer... Well, basically, what they do with people like that is once they retire, they're simply replaced. I mean, not replaced.
Yeah, attrition
exactly.
Is not...
I mean, that's how they handle that equation. They basically go and they simply say, you got to do more.
And where things like this national security scandal is concerned... The problem you run into is that it is run with so little transparency that contract oversight itself becomes almost impossible.
Well,
because we can't tell you how much actually we're paying because that's top secret.
Well, I can tell you for a contract employee with so little qualifications, this guy to make $120,000 a year, and that's what his real salary was, $120,000. Okay, 120, 125.
Yeah, he said that when he said it was 200,000, he was using the highest level of his earnings, but that was not what he was earning at the time that he made the data dump.
No, I think if I were Mr. Snowden, I think he's probably in the right place so he can make a beeline for Beijing. But I'm sure they can use his services there. He must be quite a talented young man as far as computers are concerned, right?
You know, that remains to be seen.
I just wondered exactly what he will do, because espionage is pretty serious. And somebody is going to take care of that situation. And maybe they should.
Well, a lengthy extradition proceeding is about to be launched, according to the story that broke earlier this evening. It was interesting that they have had this, they've had these charges for a week, but they unsealed them at about 4 o'clock this afternoon.
Well, I can tell you one thing, then the sands of time or through the glass are running very quickly for him. And if I were he, I would be making fast tracks for China, because somebody will reach out and they will touch him. And I'm not talking about making a telephone conversation.
You really think the United States would go and assassinate
him? I would. Absolutely.
You would, Jim? You would
yes,
go and
sir.
Murder you would go and murder a human being?
Bob, let me tell you something. When it gets to the situation when you're dealing with national security and things of that nature, and you have somebody do what he's done, then, you know, maybe it's just my background. But yeah, I would.
But that's the problem. What has he done? He has, under the, well, it's kind of hard to tell, based on the quality, based on the quality of reporting. But what we publicly know he has done is tell the American people in the world that the government is spying on them.
Well, that's just the tip of the iceberg there, as far as the minds of the people who are in these agencies like FBI and CIA. And CIA is definitely authorized to go in and send somebody to take care of that situation.
The president himself has argued that he has the power to order the extrajudicial assassination of an American citizen if he so desires.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. That's where I base what I've just said. I mean, what I've said is, you know, not anything to be surprised about or horrified about. It's just reality.
Well, no, I find it a little surprising that you yourself say that you would go and...
Why?
Because that generally has not been the tenor of your nature, as I understand it.
Well, let me put it to you this way. Unfortunately, in life, things are not always as they seem.
Okay.
And that's the whole leitmotif. That's the whole underground feeling of that type of situation. When you have an individual who can possibly cause a real problem. And I'm not sure what's going on there, but you know, what I'm doing is I'm just playing the devil's advocate here and saying this is exactly what they want to do and probably what will happen if he doesn't get out of Hong Kong quickly enough.
Well, the unsealed charges ask for him to be detained pending the extradition hearing or the extradition process.
Well, I can tell you this, if he in fact is extradited, and if they do not kill him, they will make it to the point that he would wish that he were dead, and he has said that himself. Now, he did say that himself in his initial interview 2 weeks ago on one of the, I think, CNN. And he said that. He said that he would rather his life end rather than to be taken back. And I'm sure, and what I'm saying is, there were a number of people who are been tasked with the particular function in which to give him his wish. Bob, national security...
It will be a dark day for America if that comes true.
Well, I don't think so, because, I mean, this has happened so many times. This has happened so many times. Don't be naive, sir.
Of course it'll be a dark day, because that's contrary to the entire structure of the government as it was put in place.
Maybe it's
we have due process. We have equal protection.
Maybe.
They either mean something, Jim, or they do not. Now, I have frequently argued that the Constitution has been made a fluid document in large part because this is empire and that is how empires behave. I do not say that because I approve of it. I say that because it appears to be a reflection of reality.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, the world of reality.
But I do not wish for it to be real. And if my country wants to run around assassinating people in my name, oh, hell no. I find that sickening and, frankly, contrary to the every idea, if not reality, every idea of what this country is about. And I'm not going to just accept it as a matter of course is a country that's that has devolved to the state of murder incorporated.
I guess your perception and my perception are different because I've seen things happen. I know things have happened, and I know how it works. And that's just that's history. It's documented. That's all I'm saying. And as far as what you think the government ought to be and should be and this, that, and the other that's written in such lofty heights are concerned, it doesn't necessarily mean that because these things are governed and they're controlled and implemented by human beings. And some of these human beings aren't very nice. And they're not paid to be nice. That's the point of what I'm trying to tell you. I'm just being realistic. Totally. Seen too much of it.
Now, that may very well be, Jim. I can't speak to that. Only you can.
Well, I can, and believe you me, I don't necessarily enjoy speaking to it, but nonetheless, that's the way the world works. Bob, the world's a very dangerous place in so many ways. You know, it's a very dangerous place. And we all live in castles that are built upon sand. We do.
Well, we shall have to wait and see. I prefer the fact that if they're going to... I mean, charging him with the Espionage Act is serious business, as Sandra noted. And it'll be interesting to see
Espionage
that...
Espionage is punishable by death.
Yes.
But like I say, the world is a very dangerous place, and we all live in castles that are built in sand. And that's basically what you've been talking about all night, or the fact that everything in this world and everything that man represents and has, and this, that, and the other, basically represents the fact that everything is not built on solid, this, that, and the other. It's built on sand. And that's what I've gotten from the conversation tonight, and maybe I'm wrong. But that's, you know, I'm not a stupid person.
Didn't suggest you are, Jim.
And you and I have talked a lot of times about a lot of things just like this. We've talked about this way when Bamberg wrote that book about the CIA and the National Security Administration back in 2005. And I recommended that book for you to read. You didn't read it. So, I mean, I suggest that you take a look at some of the writings that have been put out on the National Security Administration and its contract people and what these people are paid to do and what they will do and do so with impunity and without regret. It's just the way of the world, my friend. So I'm not trying to rain on your parade or anything.
No, I understand. One thing attaches to this, Jim, though, Jim. The country that resorts to that, well...
We've been doing it for years. We've been doing it for years, Bob. You know that.
The country that resorts to that, though,
does that to what?
Will not long. Well, it won't last.
You think not?
Yeah.
Well, maybe so, maybe not. But you know, like I say, I've seen a lot of stuff come and go, and people come and go, and. You know, people might think that they're indispensable and this, that, and the other, but as far as what they do and this is concerned, but, you know, cemeteries are filled with indispensable people.
And isn't that the truth? I'm going to try to get another call in, Jim. You have a good night.
Likewise.
Bye now. Our old buddy Jim. Onward for the last couple of minutes. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello?
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Mark.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. Thanks for taking my call. I know you're at the end of the show. G. Gordon Liddy, he actually, I guess, had the impression that he would be taken out for being caught as a Watergate burglar. And Nixon didn't take him out. And also, Daniel Ellsberg, who was the captain in the Korean War with the Marine Corps, I mean, which we all know that, but people listen to your show. Daniel Ellsberg basically showed the corporate interests of, you know, the people. No one took Ellsberg out. Though Nixon actually did talk about it, they said, but instead they destroyed him in the press through his fact he was seeing a psychologist, whatever the case. But also the Walker spy case, the low-ranking Navy officer who was giving away the naval shooting arrangements that they were going to do before the Marines or the Army would take a hill. And then he would get that information to the Russians in Mexico City, and then they give it to the Chinese and then the North Vietnamese, and the North Vietnamese would evacuate the hills. The Navy would come and bomb, and then Walker could drive a Jaguar, and the Marines would go up the hill and get wiped out by overwhelming odds. But same with the Army. But you know, not saying that people, but the point is, this guy didn't. He hasn't released anything. Whether he's even given that innuendo, I still think, I'm not putting words in your mouth. I think he's kind of, I think we're all being played. I think they were trying to catch the tail end of an attempt to destroy what credibility President Obama had with their fake momentum concerning the Benghazi, the IRS thing, and
it does fall out there a little bit conveniently, doesn't it, Mark?
It does seem to be, and I think if you read all the crap that the, I'll hang up, Bob, but if you read all the crap that the right wingers talk about, I think that they're caught up in their own storm of inaccuracy. So it's just the people that are more objective and a little more cautious and more patriotic and objective don't seem to fall for the propaganda. So thank you for last night's guest, that gentleman and yourself. It's very enlightening, and thank goodness for good West Virginians. North Alabamians. So I'll hang up, Bob, and listen to y'all.
Thanks, Mark. You take care and have a good weekend.
All right, brother.
Bye now. Mark calling from Florida. Time to get out of here. Thanks, everybody, for helping us end the week on a positive note for fundraising. In addition to the thanks that went out earlier this evening, thank you, Gordon. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to the bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and acact.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Have a good weekend, everybody. Catch you on Monday.